And we are live from America and just outside the Matrix. It is time for the show that makes you smarter every day, the best damn radio show in the world, I dare say, and the show that brings you the truth behind the headlines. I'm investigative journalist Lee Stranahan, and this is The Backstory. Okay, another great show today. Rod, our intrepid producer, has lined up for us today. Got a couple of great guests. Joining us first, Ahmed Cavallo will be joining us. He is a reporter, former aide to George Galloway, the great George Galloway, our former parliamentarian, badass mofo, I might say, as well. So we'll talk to, I want to talk to Ahmed about that. Actually, Rod, did you know that Ahmed worked for George Galloway for a few years?
Actually, I did. I forgot to mention that, but I did know that.
See, you should have told me sooner. I want to talk to him about it. But it's nice with doing longer interviews. We can do that. We got a lot of stuff. He just did a big, tell the people who he interviewed, Rod, because he just did another big interview.
Yeah, Ahmed went to Sudan, where his home country, and interviewed the Minister of Information for the government of Sudan and about their involvement with the funding, the extortion for Israel on America's behalf.
Yeah, got the guy in some trouble, I guess, right? But we'll be talking to Ahmed about that, and I also want to talk to him because he's actually interviewed Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, and he knows quite a bit about Venezuela. And so, again, we always love having Ahmed on the show, and he's got a great voice, too, I got to say. He's got one of those accents. Then, joining us will be John Hoag, WJJ Hoag, as he goes by, and we'll be talking about the Brett Kimberlin story. We'll be doing a deep dive because, you know, this, Rod, it's been 2 years since I wrote the story and published it up on Medium. It's been over 2 years. It's been like 2 years and 4 days. On December 5th, 2018, I wrote a story about a DNC operative, Alexandra Chalupa, admitting she was working with the DOJ and the DHS and working with this group connected to a convicted felon, serial bomber, adjudicated pedophile, not good guy, Brett Kimberlin. And we'll be talking to John about that. And, of course, potentially, I say, the most important guest is you, 202-521-1320, 202-521-1320. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. There's a few headlines I want to get to, but I got to tell you, with John, I mentioned some of the myriad topics we'll be talking to Ahmed about. John, I want to talk about this anyway. We've been sort of hinting around the sides of it a little bit. Is all the weird messaging I'm seeing about UFOs and extraterrestrials and other stuff? Did you see the guy from Israel, the head of their space program, basically, Rod? Did you see the statements he made about the Galactic Empire? Did you see that?
No, I didn't. I didn't see that. But I did see there was a Israel told Trump about UFOs. I saw that circulating. So that was pretty interesting.
And the guy who's head of their space program, not just some guy on the street wearing a propeller cap, said there's a Galactic Empire and the U.S. is known about. And so what he's saying is, a friend of mine pointed this out, what he's saying is that the U.S. has known about this, and Israel and the U.S. have talked about it, but the U.S. government didn't tell us. The American people, we can't know about this. Now, I'm going to say, I'm agnostic on whether this is true or not. I suspect, and, you know, call me suspicious, I suspect there's some information games going on here. But the reason I mention this in relationship with our guest, John Hoag, is John actually works for NASA. So I'm curious what he says about this. And there's also this monolith thing that we've been talking about. Now, have you been following that at all, Rod? I mean, it's hard to miss it. But have you been following the monolith?
Yeah, I have some. I forget exactly where the new one just popped up yesterday, where a couple of kids were sliding down it, you know. So.
Right. And Puddings, I believe it was El Paso, Texas. I believe that's where it was. And this seems really stupid to me. That's the problem I've got, is a lot of this stuff seems like I'll put it like this. I've got an 8-year-old. I don't think this would fool the 8-year-old. I'll put it like this. It didn't fool whatever kid's parents. If there was an action, let's go over this, right? So let's say aliens put some weird monolith down on Earth. I wouldn't let my kids play on it. You see what I'm saying? I've seen the Twilight Zone. I'm just like, I don't think that'll go well. No, kids, get off the monolith. You can't. No, don't touch. No, don't give your Reese's Pieces to that alien. Stop. You don't know where that alien's been or whether they're legal. But the point is, especially in El Paso, I don't think extraterrestrial aliens are the biggest problem there, but I digress. It is so stupid, and the news coverage I've seen of it makes it especially stupid. Here's an example. The headline, and I believe this was on Fox, said the monolith mysteriously disappeared. And then they said a reporter saw it and later went back and it wasn't there. Okay, so far we got a headline that promises mystery. We've got a little bit of a possibly mysterious incident where a reporter goes back and can't find it. Then, like the next paragraph, Rod, like almost like literally, they didn't even bury the lead. And if they did bury it, they just threw some dust on it. It was not a very good burial. The next thing they say is that the monolith was put in a truck. There's video showing that a couple dudes put it in their truck and drove it off. What? What? That's not a mystery. And by the way, if you're putting an alien monolith in your truck, and the other one that was out in Utah, some dudes just came and took it. So I don't know what's going on. And I don't know if John's going to be able to get to the bottom of this, but this is a continuing thing. And because here's the other thing. Again, a friend of mine pointed out, one of the first directors of the CIA, I think the first director of the CIA, later headed the civilian panel on extraterrestrial whatever. Now, there is a long history of the deep state, however you want to define that term, the deep state, being fishy about alien stuff. Now, here's a little known fact. And I say that because I guarantee you didn't know this. My father, Rod, you've heard of Roswell, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Roswell, New Mexico. There was an Air Force base there. My father, Dick Stranahan, the Gulf Pro, was stationed at Roswell in the 50s when around the same time that happened. And I will tell you what he told me he saw. Nothing. He said, I didn't see anything. He said, there was nothing going on. He said, Roswell, during the Korean conflict, my father was an umpire. He was an athlete his whole life. So at Roswell, when he was in the Air Force, he just umpired baseball games. That's the main thing he did between, you know, bored troops and Roswell. But he said he didn't see anything. But I like to point out that my dad was at Roswell because it's an interesting conversation starter, particularly, you know, with the right crowd. I don't even know. I think my son, Shane, who's a co-host of Fault Lines here on Sputnik, along with Jamal Thomas, I think he knows that. I think I've talked to him about it, but I don't know. Rod, someone's pointing out your excitement.
Yeah, you know, Jamal on the videos, that guy dancing in the video, he might have visited Roswell.
It's possible, yes. I got these dancing animations, and I had to use them on someone. And Jamal seems, you may see Dancing Shane very soon. But everyone, I got to point out, Rod, you know, for instance, I like your deadpan, because you're not faking it. And I can, you know, you're a person, you know, you're fairly dead. Would you describe yourself as deadpan, Rod?
I'm going to be honest. I don't know what that means.
Okay. It's not bad. It just, I'll put it like this. You're not extra boisterous, shall we say. Right? You don't go mental. You're calm. That's what I think. That's a good way of putting it. You're fairly calm about things.
Oh yeah. I definitely would agree with that. And, I also, keep myself muted. So
yeah, good. Yeah, that's good. But anyway, so that's one story. Now, there's the other thing that's going on is there's this Texas lawsuit. The attorney general of the state of Texas, and he's now been joined by a bunch of states, including my state, South Dakota, the state I'm in at least, have joined this lawsuit that they took straight to the Supreme Court. And a lot of people on the right who are Trump supporters are acting like this is it. Okay, now this is it. Now, okay. I will say two things. First off, I talked to a couple lawyers I know who've been critical of the shenanigans of Sidney Powell. And all the shenanigans will come up here in a second. They've been critical of the shenanigans of Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood, who they didn't think were bringing something serious. And we'll talk to John about this later as well. They say with this lawsuit, they may be onto something, because at least this seems like a serious effort to address a constitutional issue. And so we'll see what happens. I'm not hopeful, and the people I talked to weren't hopeful, but at least this seems like a serious effort. Now, speaking of shenanigans, so you know who Cynthia Johnson is, right, Rod?
Yes.
So she's up in Michigan, and I guess she's a state senator. Did you see the big rainbow scarf thing she was wearing the other day?
Yeah, I did.
Far be it from me to criticize someone's fashion sense, but that did seem a little odd, didn't it? It's just a little, I've seen some rainbow design. I'm not even knocking the rainbow design. I've seen it done well. That one just seemed a little odd. It was somewhere between a tie-dye design that would stink of patchouli and a pride float gone wrong. I'm not sure what was going on with it. But anyway, let's play this clip. This is Cynthia Johnson. She's gotten in some trouble for this. This is a video she made. Let's hear the audio of Cynthia Johnson, shall we?
This is just a warning to you Trumpers. Be careful. Walk lightly. We ain't playing with you. Enough of the shenanigans. Enough is enough. And for those of you who are soldiers, you know how to do it. Do it right. Be in order. Make them pay.
What the actual F is that about, Rod? I mean, seriously, it's sort of more threatening because it's like she's not coming out and saying what she's really thinking, which is she's clearly implying we will beat you up, correct? I mean, am I wrong in thinking, am I a little paranoid in thinking that she's telling Trumpers there were people who will beat you up unless you shut up?
No, I think she's pretty direct with on what she's saying. She's saying any Trump supporters out there, there will be violence.
Now, speaking of shut up, YouTube has announced that if you talk about widespread election fraud, they will take your videos down. And I don't even know what that means. Like, so for instance, if I say I haven't seen legal proof of widespread voter fraud, will I get taken because I'm talking about it? What if I say, but I'm open to it? At what point do I get shut down? I don't know. I really don't want to find out either. But of course, that's the chilling effect that they have. Now, on the flip side of that, 48 states have joined a lawsuit against Facebook for non-competitive practices that may spell real trouble for Facebook. So that's the other thing in the headlines I want to point out. But this YouTube thing, I got to say, once again, chilling effect, very dangerous. And but, you know, there you go. They have too much power. They really do. when even libertarians are going, yeah, maybe they have too much power. They have too much power. We got more coming up. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. We are back. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. Someone in the chat room is asking, who was Cynthia Johnston? She's a state senator from Michigan. And by the way, Saturday Night Live, I watched a little bit of it on YouTube, like 3 minutes, and then I got a little sick to my stomach. They did a sketch, and they were mocking the woman from Michigan, Melissa, I think her name was, who testified, who had the glasses and the big scarf. And she also, she said she'd been threatened, her family had been threatened, but she was going to testify. And Cynthia Johnston was really weird in her questioning of that woman. It was really weird. And Saturday Night Live did nothing to make fun of Cynthia Johnston, which they could have. That would have been more interesting. They just made fun of the Melissa woman. And by the way, did a good job of making fun of the Michigan woman. They had that the woman has that Michigan accent, which I had said this to Hope the other day, because Hope's got a great Southern accent and I love her voice. And I said to her, but it, you know, I would love you no matter what your voice was like, unless you were from Michigan. And the reason I said that from her is, and I really mean this, and if you're from Michigan, God bless you. But, you know, you're probably not looking to date me anyway. But there are some voices and accents that are like nails on chalkboard. And everybody's got them. Some people hate Southern accents. But that Michigan accent, oh, my God. There's something about it. It's almost like a Minnesota, South Dakota thing. But it's a little more whiny. And it's just there's something about it that's just like, oh, my God. I'm sorry. It ceases arousal. Let me put it that way. Okay, unfortunately, and I hate to go from that segue to our next guest, the great journalist Amit Caballo. Hey, Amit, how you doing?
I'm good. It's actually a good segue because I'm from Birmingham in the UK, and we've actually got that reputation of having one of those annoying accents that people think sounds really slow and stupid. So actually, the segue works. I obviously disagree with that analysis, but that's the reputation that people from Birmingham have over here in the UK.
Well, let me tell you, I said before when we were introducing you way early in the show that you have a great accent. I think you have a great accent. But, you know, I'll tell you the experience I had with this. I was working in Oxnard, California at Domino's Pizza, and I was a manager there. And I was the only manager who wasn't Hispanic. Everybody else was Mexican. And a guy came in and he ordered a pizza in Mexican and he left. And by the way, you could order pizza Mexican and I could, if you want hongos or chili luce or cebolla or whatever, I could take your order because I learned enough Mexican to do that. And the guy left and my manager, Ignacio, was cracking up. He was laughing his butt off. And I said, what's so funny? He said, did you hear that guy's accent? And I was like, no, it just sounded like somebody speaking Spanish. And so I realized, of course, so you, to me, you sound great, Amit. You sound fantastic. But I'll tell you who I think does sound, if anybody should get that reputation, it's the people from Liverpool, I think. I guess the Beatles made it cool, but that's a little bit of a slower accent, isn't it? Go ahead. Pick on the people in Liverpool. I dare you. Go ahead, Amit.
Yeah, the people in Liverpool, they seem to have a bit of saliva at the back of their throat. So when they speak a little bit like this, and they suck, and they sound like a bit of saliva. But the reason why people from Birmingham have got a bad reputation is we generally speak quite slow, and we're like, are you all right, Bab? How are things? How is your day going? So because we speak slow, people think that's a reflection of how quick our brain works. But you're onto a point there because to me, everyone in the United States, apart from the people from the South and people from places like New York, you all kind of sound the same. And I think if you're not from that country, it's very difficult to differentiate between the accents, unless there's obviously a massive distinction, like I said, between the South and places in New York. I mean, I couldn't tell you what a Minnesota accent sounds like. Or what was the other place that you mentioned that you insulted the state from?
Michigan. Horrible. Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you what that sounds like. It all kind of sounds the same to me. Yankee accent.
Minnesota. The way to get that one is watch Fargo.
So it sounds like Canadian, a little bit Canadian-ish.
A little bit. Minnesota, they get a little bit of thing. Minnesota, I'm not going to try to do it right now because I'd have to have some dialogue. But basically, Minnesota, they say that. And South Dakota's got a similar thing. You can tell it if you're listening for it. Now, actually, on the subject of accents, that's another good segue. Let's talk about George Galloway for a second, because that dude has – I love George's voice, first off.
That Scottish accent when he rolls the R's. For emphasis, yeah, he's got a great voice, especially when he's taking on U.S. senators and putting them in their place.
Exactly right. The great George Galloway. I just love the and of course, he's Irish, but Scottish. But, you know, he grew up in Scotland, but he's Irish. So he's got a great mixture. Now, I didn't know, Ahmed, that you actually worked for Galloway for a few years. And I do love George. What was that experience like for you? I hope it was good. Otherwise, this will be an embarrassing little segment for everybody. But what was it like working for George Galloway?
Do you know what? It was a great experience because, obviously, he's one of the best public speakers, not only in the UK, but possibly the world. And it gives you confidence because everything that you learn at university or college at school is about public speaking. He just basically rips up the rule book and just tells you just speak to people as if you were speaking to a friend. And don't think about it too much. And I feel like I've got better at public speaking because of that. So I never really have notes. If I'm ever doing any public speaking, I've got a rough idea of what I'm going to say in my head. And I just go for it. And I think I only got that from basically following him around for a couple of years and just watching him do his stuff. I'm not saying in any way I'm comparable or I've mastered the skill as Galloway has. But definitely watching someone do it so confidently, definitely, I feel like rubs off. Can't get my words out as I'm talking about how much of a great public speaker I am. It definitely rubs off on you.
Yeah, no, I can imagine when Julian Assange was taken to Belmarsh Prison, I went out there. They sent me out there for Sputnik, like the next day, basically. And I went out there, and Galloway spoke, and Chris Williamson spoke, and I spoke, and Patrick Henningsen spoke, and I got to intro Galloway. And as I said to friends later, that's good because I don't want to follow that guy. I don't want George Galloway as my, like, I don't want to have to compete with that. Like, I'd rather go, and here's George, everybody, and just have him do his thing. Now, what do you make of the stuff that's been going on with Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party? I mentioned Chris Williamson. People may not know who he is in the U.S., but he was a Labour MP who's accused of anti-Semitism, as George was accused of anti-Semitism, which is why he was booted from talk radio and now is on Sputnik, where he has a show. And of course, he's on RT. But what do you think is going on there? What do you make of that whole situation?
I'm so glad you asked me about that because I'm from Sudan, because I've been to Venezuela, I usually just get asked about those two topics. And this is something that I feel very passionate about because I was one of the thousands, tens of thousands that paid our membership for Jeremy Corbyn to join the Labour Party, to vote for Jeremy Corbyn to be the leader of the Labour Party. I even went out campaigning in the last two general elections for Jeremy Corbyn. But of course, the principal responsibility for all of this, and I don't say this with any malice because I think deep down he's a good guy, is Jeremy Corbyn himself, because a scorpion will sting. That's what scorpions do. That's what you expect them to do. Now, the right within the Labour Party was always going to attack Jeremy Corbyn, was always going to smear Jeremy Corbyn, as was the mainstream media, because of what Jeremy Corbyn represented. He represented a existential threat to the military-industrial complex in the United Kingdom, to the weapons manufacturers, to the alliances with the Persian Gulf kingdoms like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, which we sell weapons by the billions to, as well as Israel, because obviously he was a longtime supporter of Palestine. So Jeremy Corbyn is old enough and he's been campaigning long enough to know that when he gets into that position, he's going to be attacked by those within the Labour Party, which in itself, like the Democratic Party in the United States, is an imperialist party. He knows he's going to be attacked by the right, and he also knows he's going to be attacked by the mainstream media. Now, with that knowledge that you're going to be attacked, there's only two things you can do. You can run, you can hide, or you can stand up and face them. And unfortunately, Jeremy Corbyn didn't stand up and fight. He decided to run, and he ran, and they chased him. And in the process, those that were a bit more courageous than him, such as Chris Williamson, who was one of the biggest supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, such as George Galloway in the early days, and many other Labour activists, such as Mark Wadsworth, who was instrumental in bringing Nelson Mandela to the UK, Jackie Walker, the list goes on. I could be here all night. All those people that were the biggest supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, he threw them under the bus. What I mean by throwing them under the bus, he didn't. When they were attacked by this witch hunt smear campaign that tried to paint Jeremy Corbyn, one of the leading anti-racist figures in the UK, as somehow being an anti-Semite, he didn't defend them. He accepted their suspension and their expulsion from the Labour Party and didn't defend them. And it was obvious that the witch hunt would eventually narrow down to Jeremy Corbyn himself. And that's precisely what's happened. And now Jeremy Corbyn himself has been suspended, he's been suspended from the parliamentary Labour Party, but not the Labour Party itself, because they know legally they can't do that. But he is no longer a Labour MP. He's an independent MP who's part of the Labour Party, but has had the whip removed away from him. And the only message that I think people need to understand is, if we're ever going to get someone from the left in that position again, they have to have the cojones to take on the establishment. And when they get smeared, they need to do what Hugo Chavez did to Fox News and say, you guys are Fox News. You've got no right to attack me. You are the worst, most despicable news organizer. Jeremy Corbyn needed some of that Chavez spice, but he just didn't have it.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, and again, when I say I love Galloway, and I'm on the right. Okay. So it has nothing to do with policy stuff. But the thing I realized was, Williamson and Galloway and the people you're talking about are anti-war, and I'm anti-war, right? I'm anti-war. I'm anti-military industrial complex. And despite having almost nothing in common policy-wise with them, I could see the same attacks going on. Think about this, Ahmed. Donald Trump, whatever you think of him, there's been absolutely nobody. I can't think of a modern president who's been more of a suck up to Israel in terms of policy, who's given Israel literally everything they wanted. Yet, go look in the media, he's accused over and over of being an anti-Semite. Now ponder that for a second. If Donald Trump, again, the Golan Heights, Jerusalem, if he's accused of anti-Semitism, it shows you that it's a tactic to keep people in line. It has nothing to do with any ideology except a pro-war, pro-military industrial complex. They'll do it to people on the left in the UK. They'll do it to people on the right in America. And it doesn't even make any difference how pro-Israel you are. Donald Trump's never said anything positive about the Palestinians, ever, right? Doesn't make any difference. They still call him anti-Semite. Do you think I'm off base there, Ahmed?
I mean, I think he's the anomaly where he is one of those people that is supportive of Israel and still called an anti-Semite. Most of the people that are called anti-Semites, including many Jews, by the way, we've just had Naomi Wintz Braun, I think her name is. She's a Jewish member of the Labour Party, who was just kicked out of the Labour Party for saying that she's a pro-Palestinian Jew. So most of the time, if you're kicked out of the Labour Party or attacked as an anti-Semite, it doesn't matter your ethnic origin, because they've managed to make Zionism and anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism synonymous with one another. So I think Trump is the anomaly there. But one thing you've got to admire about Trump is he increased his support base because people like to see someone sticking up for themselves. Now, I oppose everything that Donald Trump stands for, and I think he's a despicable human being. But I do think there's something admirable about the fact that when he gets attacked by CNN and these other entities, he turns it around and attacks them. And there's a lot to attack CNN and the New York Times and these so-called liberal media establishment papers about. And that's the thing that Jeremy Corbyn lacked. We were saying it time and time again, privately, not publicly, because we would have been ridiculed. But Corbyn needs to be a bit more like Trump. They had similarities in the sense that they were both being smeared and attacked at the same time. But if you look at the way that Trump turned those attacks around, and you look at the way that Corbyn basically ran away and basically ran away and hid away and hoped that the attacks would stop. They'll never stop. People like to see your leader standing up for themselves, standing up for the movement, and standing up for the values and the causes that you're behind. And Jeremy Corbyn simply failed to do that.
Well, and let me say this, too. I think one of the reasons that Trump, I know what you mean by he's an anomaly, except not in the U.S. And here's what I mean by that. In the U.S., I can't think of a single Democrat who's in any leadership position at all who is anti-war, anti-military industrial complex, period. There's just nobody, certainly not Pelosi, certainly not Schumer. And furthermore, and we had a guest on the other day, we were talking about this, grassroots Democrats have become servile to entities like the CIA. And that's not, and it's shocking to a lot of Democrats. It is shocking how quickly the Democrats became, yay, CIA, yay, FBI, after being the opposition with the Church Committee and other things like that. When Galloway came over and made a speech to the Senate, about the Iraq War, there was at least some semblance of some people who were well known. They have decimated the peace movement in the U.S. by taking all the Democrats from it. And so, you know, when Trump was trying to remove troops during his presidency, it was the Democrats who opposed him. Yes, it was a lot of Republicans, too, but it was the Democrats who opposed him. The only high profile anti-war people I can think of are people like Rand Paul, who's a Republican. So that's one of the dynamics over here. I think it's different in the UK, but I think they're trying to make it the same. They're trying to expunge the anti-war people from the left. What does that make some sense?
Yeah, 100% makes sense. And I think nothing symbolizes that more in the US than Trump's greatest achievement in my eyes as US president was some sort of peace agreement with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And the way that he was attacked by the so-called left and by the Democrats in the US for making peace, I mean, it's so outrageous to be attacked by people that claim to be on the left for making peace with an entity that has nuclear, it doesn't have declared nuclear weapons, but many people suspect they have nuclear weapons, and a country that the United States in the last century had gone to war with, and that war cost a lot of Korean lives and American lives. That should be something that should be lauded as an achievement, but he was attacked. I remember Ice Cube, the rapper, was on CNN, and the anchor at the time was basically saying to him, "What's he doing? What's Trump doing?" And Ice Cube was like, "Well, this is peace. They've come to peace." Ice Cube was talking about Dennis Rodman. Dennis Rodman went to North Korea and he was attacked, and Ice Cube was saying, "Well, this is no different to the ping pong diplomacy with the Chinese in the 70s." And I think there's this idea when it comes to foreign policy that the left and the right are united. They disagree when it comes to domestic concerns, such as the minimum wage, such as wage conditions, such as healthcare. But when it comes to foreign policy, they seem to be two cheeks at the same backside and singing from the same hymn sheet. And I think that's the problem, that when someone like Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn seems to fracture that what two-party system and offer some real change, then you see elements of the Labour Party, of the Democratic Party, doing everything they can to undermine their campaign and make sure that they don't win the leadership position. And if they do win the leadership position, they do everything they can so that they don't actually win the general election. In the United Kingdom, I don't know if the story reached the US because it was heavily censored over here. In 2017, there were party members of the Labour Party, Labour HQ, who were paid to get Labour elected, who were undermining Jeremy Corbyn's general election and purposely allocating resources, not so that they could win the general election, but so that the right within the party could be re-elected as MPs. And we only lost, the Labour Party only lost that election by a few thousand votes. So we have them actually working against seeing the Labour Party come into power, because they'd much rather have a Boris Johnson Conservative government than a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour government. And I think it's the same thing in the US. I think they'd much rather have a two-term Donald Trump than a one-term Bernie Sanders. And we saw that with the Hillary Clinton campaign, because everyone and their dog knows that Bernie probably would have beat Donald Trump in 2016. But they did everything in their power to make sure that he didn't get on the ticket and he wasn't the Democratic nominee.
Okay, we got more coming up. Amit Cavallo is joining us. And we will talk about Sudan and Venezuela and Iran with Amit coming up after this. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is the best damn radio show in the world. It's The Backstory. We are back. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. If you're in Washington, D.C., and you have a radio with an antenna, you can listen to us on 105.5 FM, AM 1390. In Kansas City, pick one. Missouri, Kansas, doesn't really make any difference. 102.9, 104.7, and 1140 AM. And, of course, all over the damn internet, joined now by journalist Amit Cavallo. And so let's talk. You mentioned it was nice to talk about something other than Venezuela or Sudan, but let's get into both of those. Sorry, Amit.
No, I like talking about those things. It's just I also like talking about the Labour Party, and I never usually get an opportunity to, so thank you for that.
No, you bet. It's one of the things we've been doing, these longer interviews on the show. I tried it a few weeks ago, and it's really nice, actually, to be able to do like a 45-minute interview with somebody, because you can get into stuff in 15 minutes. We got to hit the highlights. You know what I mean? And it's nice to be able to get more in depth. Now, you said, I want to go back before we get, this will segue us, because I'm a professional broadcaster, Amit. I'm good at segues. I like to tell myself. We're going to segue into the Venezuela thing by something you mentioned. And I want to point it out. Somebody in the chat room showed disgust when you said that Corbyn should show some of the same spine that a guy like Hugo Chavez showed. But I'm going to point out that you also said you wish he'd, I think you said this, that you wish he'd shown some of the spine Trump shows. You got to push back on this stuff. And so whatever Chavez's ideology, and we'll talk about that in a second. One of the things about Chavez, like that, the time, you remember this time when Hugo Chavez stood up at the podium and Bush had been there and he made the joke about smelling sulfur.
I don't think it was a joke. I think he really thought George W. Bush was the Antichrist. But I do.
that was a very actually kind of Trump-like moment. You could picture Trump saying something like that. And I think that there's something about Chavez and Trump in that they both speak bluntly sometimes. I mean, Chavez is no longer with us, obviously, but there was something about them, and they weren't afraid. They weren't acting. They weren't couching everything in well, political speak, we need to talk with a certain tone of voice, the way we discuss things, and
yeah,
not modulate our voice too much. And you know what I'm getting at, right? I mean, what's your take on that?
I get what you're getting at, but out of respect for the late, great Hugo Chavez, I'd like to make a distinction that Chavez was obviously a well-read man, very articulate. And whenever he would recommend a book, it would be sold out within months in Venezuela. So he was intellectually on a completely different stratosphere than Donald Trump. But you're right in the sense that there was a certain, dare I say, courage in their convictions, that what they believed in, they actually believed in and were willing to defend. Now, Jeremy Corbyn certainly believes in what he believes in, but he doesn't have the same, I don't know, combative approach in defending that. And in this vicious environment that is politics, especially in the Western world, you need to be able to defend your point fiercely and fearlessly. And I think the problem with Jeremy Corbyn, he said he wanted to change politics the way politics is done in the UK. He wanted a more respectable politics, but it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. When the Daily Mail is calling him a Hezbollah supporter, Hamas supporter, an anti-Semite, this and that, and he refuses to say anything back about the Daily Mail and who owns the Daily Mail and what was behind the headlines and why they would be writing these articles about him, then it confuses his support base, because unfortunately in this kind of arena, though, the person that's loudest is often the one that's heard.
Yeah, no, it's and I think that when the media structure is so aggressive on some points, and this takes us to Venezuela, and I made it, and again, I'm on the right, okay, and therefore there's a number of things I could criticize about Venezuela. However, when it comes to human rights, I did this on Twitter. I said, let's compare two countries, one of whom is a U.S. ally and one of whom is a U.S. sworn enemy. The ally is Saudi Arabia. The enemy is Venezuela. And if I'm trying to be fair and objective about it, and I really mean this by any standard, I don't understand if you're just looking at it in human rights, or even, for instance, there were no Venezuelan hijackers involved in 9/11, for instance, if we want to go to the terrorism thing. Saudi Arabia has a bunch of oil. Venezuela's got even more oil. But there's nothing about Saudi Arabia that, to me, makes them a huge champion of human rights. You can't practice Christianity openly in Saudi Arabia, for instance. Let's just start there, right? And Venezuela has churches, okay? So you'd think, even coming from a right-wing Christian standpoint, in the U.S., you'd look at these two countries and go, well, one of them is clearly worse than the other. Saudi Arabia's clearly worse than Venezuela. And as I go down the list of things, from the way women are treated to public executions by beheading and on and on and on, it's very clear that human rights is a sham. It's a joke. It has to do with one country goes along with the U.S., period, and has a lot of oil, and the other country pushes back on the U.S. and has a lot of oil. And so we've declared, and if we put sanctions on the Saudis and wouldn't let them do business, they would be suffering huge economic problems now. So first off, I'm curious, as somebody who's on the left, what's your take on my analysis there?
Yeah, I mean, you could even go a bit closer to home. So Colombia, which is right next door to Venezuela and shares a border with Venezuela, has a terrible human rights record. There's 5.8 million Colombians living in Venezuela, within Venezuela, all of them refugees, or most of them refugees that were displaced by the violence. 280 social leaders and trade union leaders have been executed in Colombia. It's very difficult to even organize yourself within a trade union in Colombia, but this doesn't make the news at all. And that is a US ally. So it's clear that the beef with Venezuela isn't human rights at all. It's something more than that. It's ideological because Venezuela declares it calls itself a socialist country. It's obviously the resources because Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in the world. And the Saudi Arabia example is obviously just a more extreme example of that point, because if it was about human rights, if it was about press freedoms, if it was about freedom of expression, then Saudi Arabia wouldn't be the second greatest ally to the United States in the Middle East, but yet it is. So it shows that it's actually nothing to do with that. It's just talk of these things to get their the things that they really want. And obviously that makes it palatable to a Western audience. So yeah, I think your example is right, but there's even greater examples in the Latin American region.
Well, the problem, of course, is most Americans know nothing about Colombia, but they've heard of Saudi Arabia at least. You see what I'm saying?
And
the other thing about Saudi Arabia is, if I'm critical of socialist governments, which I am, I have criticisms of socialist governments. Do you know what I'm even more critical of? Is kingdoms. it's when a government says it's a kingdom, they're not even living in modernity. They are literally, it's like something out of Disneyland or a fairy tale, where because it's so not fitting in with the modern world at all, and they don't even make the pretense of democracy in Saudi Arabia. They don't even, you know, because people go, well, right now we're hearing a lot about Sidney Powell and the elections and Dominion and all this stuff. And I'm like, they don't even have elections in Saudi Arabia. So therefore, they've never had a problem with a corrupt election. Now, you've had a question out to Maduro. What's been your experience with Venezuela that you think people, not even from an ideological standpoint, but just what do people get wrong about Venezuela that's just like has nothing to do with politics, but just their perception of it and the way Venezuela is demonized, especially in the U.S. and I assume in the U.K. But I don't know. I don't follow UK media on Venezuela. So I guess that's the first question is, has Venezuela been demonized? And if so, what should people know about it, even from a non-ideological perspective, just a day-to-day living perspective?
Yeah, I mean, just to touch on the point, because I think you made a really good point about Saudi Arabia, about its medieval nature. There was a 16-year-old crucified in Saudi Arabia for writing a blog post. And I think that kind of just typifies exactly what you're talking about. What century are we in where people are being crucified, hung to a cross, and killed? It sounds biblical, doesn't even sound real. Now, onto the point about Venezuela. The thing is, people think there's some sort of humanitarian catastrophe in Venezuela. And I think there for sure is an economic crisis. There for sure is a shortage of certain goods. But a humanitarian crisis is what you describe Yemen or South Sudan or these type of places. To use that description for Venezuela is just so inappropriate, it's untrue. The second point, people paint Venezuela to be some sort of dictatorship. Now ask yourself, Juan Guaido, who's the leader of the opposition, or was the leader of the opposition, depending on how you put it, he's attempted 3 coups in 18 months. Now, in any democracy, that wouldn't be acceptable. If Venezuela was the dictatorship that people paint out to be, then Juan Guaido would have been locked up a long time ago. And when I was in Venezuela and I was watching the national television, the Venezuelan government is criticized all the time. In the newspapers, the Venezuelan government is criticized all the time. If that Sudan was a dictatorship under Omar al-Bashir, you couldn't say anything about Bashir. You'd be wary of saying bad things about Bashir to family members, let alone on TV, let alone in the media. So I think it does a disservice to real humanitarian crises to say Venezuela is a humanitarian crisis, and real dictatorship to say that Venezuela is a dictatorship. And I think that's the two biggest misconceptions. And on the third point about being critical of socialist governments, everyone could be critical of socialist governments. That's fine. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. The thing that I find worrying is, if socialism is as bad as people make it out to be, then why don't they just let it fail on its own merits? Why do they sanction and economically isolate and embargo socialist countries. If it's so bad, then all you need to do is sit back and watch the mayhem. But they don't sit back and watch the mayhem. They systematically, economically starve the nation, cause financial transactions to be blocked, take over state assets. Now, Venezuela has a state in the United States, CITGO, that has $9 to $8 billion that Venezuela can't get out of the U.S. If socialism is as bad as Elliot Abrams and Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump say, then why do they need to do these tactics? Just let it fail. And then when it does fail, then the government will have no one else to blame but the socialist system. Now, what happens now in Venezuela is because a lot of people have political consciousness and education, they understand that the reason why they can't get so much certain goods in, the reason why toilet paper, for example, is in short supply, is because of the blockade. And when they realize it's because of the blockade and not because of socialism, then their anger is more directed towards the United States and its allies than it is against their government. Like I said, if socialism was so bad that they wouldn't do that, and the anger of the masses would be against the government and not against external entities.
Well, actually, I couldn't agree with you more. I've said that over and over. I agree 100%. Just let it fail on its own, and or let it not fail on its own, and then you've had a fair experiment. Now, we're almost out of time, and Ahmed, it's a great conversation, and we'd love to have you back on again real soon. But briefly talk about, you recently interviewed a high official in Sudan. You mentioned your Sudanese. What happened there? Explain that to people.
Yeah, I mean, it was an unbelievably frank interview. I'm a bit worried that I might have got him into trouble because of what he said. But essentially, I asked him about normalization with Israel. And he gave such a frank admission. He said that the reason why Sudan normalized relations with Israel is because as soon as the transitional government came into power, their first negotiations were with the United States to have the state sponsor of terror designation lifted. Now, the United States, even back then, was trying to push the normalization with Israel as a condition. Now, the transitional government at the time said this can't happen, that they're a transitional government and therefore their mandate isn't there. They're only there for a transitional period. It should be decided by a democratically elected government. And they also said that the state sponsor of terror designation has nothing to do with Israel. Therefore, it shouldn't be a condition to have it lifted. And then a month before the United States presidential elections, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo went to Sudan, told the transitional government that if you want the state sponsor of terror designation lifted, this needs to happen. Donald Trump needs his foreign policy win before the election. And we will not accept anything else other than normalization of Israel. Now, the transitional government at the time didn't obviously appreciate this approach, but they assessed the state of the economy. The economic minister and the economic experts analyzed and thought the economy won't last another 7 months. If it continues at the free fall rate that it's going at, then after 7 months, it'll be in a state where it'll take decades to recover. So they agreed to normalize relations with Israel simply to save the economy. And he said all this in the interview that you can watch online. And it kind of speaks to the way that the diplomacy is carried out in the United States, where they use the long queues for bread, the long queues for petrol to coerce smaller nations, poorer nations, into doing what they want.
Well, and it also, let me just say this too. I actually don't even see how this benefits the U.S. Now, first off, with Sudan, my understanding is that they were no longer in an actively aggressive posture with Israel anyway, correct? They have not been for a few years actively in a hostile position with Israel. Is that accurate?
Yeah, specifically, especially since the revolution, that the new transitional government have not been hostile with Israel at all. Yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah, and so there wasn't even a pressing need to do it, except what they're trying to do is get people to sign on to do this. And we saw this with these agreements where the U.S. is strong-arming, and Pompeo right now, seemingly knowing that his days are numbered as Secretary of State, is doing a lot of strong arming, and it's all on behalf of Israel. And it is a benefit to the U.S. I don't see it. Ahmed, seriously, always great to have you on. Let's have you back on again real soon. We got a lot to talk about. That's Ahmed Caballo, everybody. We got more coming up. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. From America and just outside the matrix. It's time for the show that brings you the truth behind the headlines. I am independent investigative journalist Lee Stranahan, and this is The Backstory. Once again, I want to thank our guest Ahmed Caballo for joining us in the first hour. Absolutely fascinating discussion on a variety of topics, and I hope it highlights for people. And I really want you to start to think about this, please. If you're feeling some cognitive dissonance, you need to understand there is more agreement among people than you would know from watching any of the media right now. Any of the media. When it comes to issues like war, when it comes to issues like the military-industrial complex, I really believe there is a silent majority who are pushed into these positions. Rod, what did you think of the interview with Ahmed there?
I thought it was great to have him on for 45 minutes, and he's young, but he's a fount of knowledge, and he's very experienced as well.
Yeah, no, he really is. And you can see, I think, that I got to tell you, if what Pompeo's doing going around the world, strong-arming countries, or just in some cases they're pushovers like the United Arab Emirates, who was not at war with Israel, into this fake deal of the century. Nobody voted on that. Trump didn't run on that. He didn't say, I don't know how else to put it. It seems like an Israel first policy. And I think even people who aren't hostile to Israel, and again, I've said it, the Palestinian issue is not my main issue. I know a lot of people who don't like Israel. For them, Palestinian rights are the top of their list. I feel about Palestinians the way I do about other countries. Dr. Avi Yaakov Shapir about this. I have an issue with the outsized influence that the state of Israel has on U.S. politics, period. I'll talk about that in a second, too. But that's the issue that I have. And joining us this hour for 45 minutes to do a deep dive on the Brett Kimberlin story, John Hogue will be joining us. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is A Backstory. Okay, so let me start to discuss what I was just talking about a little bit there, which is the apparent fealty that is unquestioned by anyone in the media. If you want to know where the power base lies in this country, just look at what you're not allowed to talk about. And I'm going to compare, once again, two countries. And so I did this with Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. I said, look, if you want to compare two countries and say, well, why is one our enemy and why is one our ally? There's nothing that makes any sense about Venezuela versus Saudi Arabia. I could understand if the U.S. said, you know what? I don't like either of these mother hubbards. I don't like Venezuela. I don't like what they're doing. But I don't like what the Saudis are doing either. I don't. Well, the problem with Venezuela is that Venezuela, man, you know, they nationalized the oil. What did Saudi Arabia do? We just nationalized it. But they suck up to British Petroleum. There's the UK again. And the US. That's the only difference. That's the only difference. Venezuela wanted some autonomy from these outside forces. Okay. Now I'm going to compare two other countries. China. you know, is in the China virus. Right. And this new story Tucker Carlson ran the other night, I see a lot of people talking about this, is the influence of China. China's got influence. Oh, okay. I'm willing to discuss that, but let's talk about Israel first. Because by the numbers and by the opposition, and I'll explain that in a second, but by the numbers, it's not even close. For instance, let's just start with this. Israel has gotten more military aid. That one small country has gotten more military aid from the United States than every other country combined. Now, when I first heard that statistic, I was a little bit skeptical, shall we say. So I looked it up. And if someone's got a different reference that they want to show me, feel free. Feel free. Someone's saying, isn't Chinese influence a difference? It absolutely is. China's got way less influence in Israel, period. Someone's asking in the chat room, isn't China? Yes, China's got way less influence in Israel. And you can tell this because you will hear criticism of China right now from one side, which is mainly it's coming from the right. Mainly it's the right wing. It's all the right wing media. Go look at the right wing media. China, the Chi-coms. The Chi-coms. Watch out. The Chi-coms. That's the Chinese communists. The Chi, it's fun to say too. Chi-coms. Right? Well, how about the Islabi? I don't know what it is. The Islab. It sounds too much like Islam. Can't use that. How about the Israeli lobby? Go look at the influence. Or furthermore, I dare you. I double dog dare you. Go watch. If you don't like Al Jazeera, that's fine. Watch Al Jazeera's multi-part series called The Lobby. There were two seasons of it that I've seen. The first season was set in the UK. Second season was set in the US. And it's a documentary series about the influence. Go watch that. Go watch that. There's no equivalent of AIPAC, for instance, on the China side. AIPAC is an open, very well, very slickly produced event where they have politicians. If you want to see, if people are worried about bipartisanship, and people are concerned that we need to bring the country together, there's no place the Democrats and Republicans are more together, smoking cigars and throwing back free bar booze at AIPAC. You get everybody there from the left and the right. Hey, look, there's Nancy Pelosi. She's on stage. Yay. Oh, hey, look there. There's John Bolton. Oh, there's Donald Trump. Hey, there's Chuck Schumer. AIPAC is the ultimate kumbaya moment for Washington, D.C. Everybody from all sides sucks up to AIPAC. And if you dare criticize it, don't forget, I think it was AOC who got criticized. I think it was AOC, but it could have been Ilhan Omar. I forget. But one of them said, it's all about the Benjamins. Someone asked her about Israel, and she said it's all about the Benjamins, which clearly means it's all about the money. It's not about, you know, Ben Shapiro and other people named Benjamin. It's about the money, although it is a funny metaphor, but okay. But it's about the money. That's what they meant. It was a little hip-hop lingo. It's all about the money. And the money is not even close. It's not. Now, here's the other thing, too. If people are critical of China, someone saying it was Ilhan Omar. Yeah, thank you. I just couldn't remember. It was some squad member. When I thought about it, I'm like, it was Omar. Sorry. That statement, she may be anti-Semitic. I don't know. But that statement wasn't. That statement wasn't. And if you're looking at the money and the influence, it's not close. Now, the point I wanted to make is people talk about the dangers of China. Let me tell you something about China. How many electronic products do you buy that were made in Israel? China, for whatever, and I'm critical of China in a lot of ways, but they're a different country. And in a sense, I don't care that much about it. It bothers me, for instance, when Chinese factory workers are literally committing suicide so I can have a nice iPhone. On the other hand, you know, I'm not giving up my iPhone because it's fantastic. So I wish they would mellow things out a little bit so workers weren't literally killing themselves, because that doesn't seem cool. On the other hand, Chinese manufacturing has been essential to the economic growth, particularly in the high-tech world. And we had Andrew Arthur on earlier in the week. I'm going to tell you the big secret of Silicon Valley. Ready? There are two aspects to tech, right? There's hardware and there's software, right? So there's the you know, your computer or your phone or your tablet or whatever. And then there's the software that runs on it. Silicon Valley has made its money on a combination of cheap Chinese manufacturing on the hardware side and cheap, largely Indian, but somewhat Chinese labor on the software side. I'm going to say that again, because as 48 states are filing suit against Facebook, this is really important to understand. And I'm not a hypocrite on it, because I will tell you, I likes my devices. I like the fact, I love the iPhone. I love my Quest 2. I like my computers. I like the $100 miracle TV that I have behind me on the video feed. And when I say a miracle TV, I'm a person who's old enough to remember when I was, you know, younger and had money, before the second marriage. When I was younger and had money, I bought a 70-inch TV. This is when I was making a bunch of money doing training in high tech and living in Pasadena. And I bought a 70-inch TV. And that TV cost me like $5,000. I think I bought it used. I bought it off Craigslist. So I think I only paid like $3,500 or something. And it was gigantic and you couldn't move it. It required three people to move it. It was the size of I'll put it like this. There are one bedroom apartments in San Francisco that are smaller than that TV was. Now, you can get a 75-inch 4K, and it was a SD TV. That TV was running as a resolution of 720 by 480, 720 pixels by 480. It was scan lines, really. I don't want to get technical on you. But I don't – if you bought a phone now that could only take a 720 by 480 picture, you just bought a dollar phone. I don't know what you bought. You can't literally, you can't get that low resolution anymore. So I love the benefits of cheap tech, but the high tech industry, it's cheap Chinese labor and cheap Indian software. And that allows them to have tremendous profit margins. If you ever read tech stuff, they'll do these breakdowns where they'll disassemble a iPhone, let's say. iPhone, I was looking at the new iPhone 12 today. I could buy one cash for $1,400. Or I could buy two of the Mac minis I bought for the same price, but I digress. But I could buy that. And what they do is they take apart the phone and they say, okay, what do we got in here? Okay, we've got this camera, we've got this chip, and then they price break it down. The $1,400 iPhone probably costs, I haven't seen it, but it's probably $25 in parts, maybe 50 or 100 at the outside, maybe, right? Then there's the software that runs it. Then there's all the blah, 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 right? But that iPhone is not very much money. It's not anywhere near $1,400 in parts. And here's the thing. It's not made in Israel. I'll tell you what is made in Israel. There is technology that's made in Israel. It's technology to kill people. because the CIA, what they do is they outsource that James Bond style technology to Israel. The same way the CIA and British intelligence outsource assassinations to Mossad. And the reason they do that is the CIA does not have a license to kill, and neither does British intelligence anymore. But the Mossad, they can kill anybody they want to. They can kill anybody they want to. And so if we need somebody killed, and you can start to read this, there's a book on Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's father. Ghislaine Maxwell, the bisexual pedophile who was involved with Jeffrey Epstein. Her father, Robert Maxwell, the media mogul, there's a book called Robert Maxwell, Israeli Super Spy. You can find it, maybe used on Amazon or something like that. But they talk about how it was a Mossad operation to take out Maxwell. Sounds right to me. When I read the book, it sounds right to me. But everybody wants to demonize China, but nobody wants to give up their cell phone. Nobody wants to throw their iPad in the garbage. Nobody wants to do that. And so be very careful about the propaganda you're being subjected to. Joining us next, John Hogue will be joining us. We'll talk about Brett Kimberlin. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. Are back. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. Joining us now, friend of mine, great friend of the show, John Hogue. Hey, John, how you doing?
Hey, it's great to talk to you again, Lee. And I am doing better than I deserve.
Good. Yeah, well, that's always nice to hear. Now, let me ask you a dumb question at first. And I have to do this because you know the tech guy, Pete, right? You know the tech guy, right?
Sure.
Yes. Pete and Jemmy. So,
yeah,
I've known Pete, as I think you know, the same way I've known you, for going on 10 years now, right? We've known each other. It's getting close to 10 years, right, John?
I think we actually physically met 7.5 years ago at CPAC, but we've been, it's been about 8 years now.
Okay, right. So it's been a while. And I've known Pete a while, but I knew him as the tech guy. So I had him on the show a couple weeks ago, and I realized I was pronouncing his name wrong. Now, I thought I knew. I want to make sure, because I was looking at your website, Hogewash, Hogewash. People can find it. And you've got a thing there on pronunciations, but you went on how to pronounce your name. And suddenly I'm frozen with fear, John. I'm panicked that I may be pronouncing it wrong, because rather than what you need to have, John, I'm going to give you some website advice. Have an audio file I can click and hear you pronounce your name, because you're saying it's a long G. And I'll be honest, my girlfriend was an English major. She got an MA. I don't know what a long G is. I'm dumb.
It's a hard G. It says a hard G on the website, a long O and a hard G.
Right, a long O and a hard G. See, that's how confused I am. So say your last name for me. Go ahead.
Hogue.
So I said it right.
Yes, Hogue.
Oh, okay. Because you can see, I was a little panicked after screwing up Pete's name. And again, I've known Pete a long time, and I felt so stupid. Then I looked at your thing, and you're talking about long O's and hard G's, and I'm like, I don't know what that is, but I think it's Hogue. Okay, Hogue. There we go.
Yes. Well, Pete's name has a soft G.
Yes. Sicilian.
Pronounced like a J.
Yes. And Jemmy. Yeah. I was saying Ingami, like he's a Japanese folding paper art, but Italian. You see what I'm saying? And so,
well, until I met him, I thought he might. I thought the name was Japanese.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. It looks a little Japanese, but I knew him as the tech guy for so long. Or Pete. Hey, Pete. You see what I'm saying? So I didn't have to say his last name. So there we go. Okay. Now I want to talk about the Kimberlin stuff, obviously, because you've been dutiful on that, but because of your NASA connection, I'm going to ask you about ETs and extraterrestrials and monoliths, because I'll tell you what I'm seeing, John. I'm seeing a lot, and I also want to talk to you about this Texas suit, because up on your website, you've got the Texas suit. But let's talk about ETs and extraterrestrials and blah, blah, blah. I have noticed in the past few weeks a lot of mainstream press talk, not Weekly World News, whatever, even I don't even know if that exists anymore, but a lot of mainstream press talk about leaks from the government, about UFOs and blah, blah, blah. Do you have anything that you can tell us, since you work at NASA, you know, scientists and stuff like that? Do you have anything, do you have any breaking news, an exclusive for us maybe, on extraterrestrial life, John?
I can actually only give you a little bit of information about Roswell.
Okay.
Yeah, because I, you know, that came up in the first hour. I will just point out that 9 months after the incident in Roswell, Al Gore was born.
Okay. Is that true, by the way? Is that accurate?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. It's better. It's better because it's true.
So there you go.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I have really noticed. Have you noticed this at all? All the scuttlebutt about this stuff?
Yeah, and basically my read on it is that it's an alternate story to distract from the real news. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on that, well, you know, the thing that Iowa Hawk says about the news media's job is to cover the news with a pillow till it stops moving. And I think there's some of that going on.
Yeah. And, well, I'll tell you the thing I'm worried about a little bit. And I was talking to my friend Vivian about this. I'm a little worried that they're trying to set up some information so that when something, when people in government do something weird, they can go, oh, maybe it was aliens. Because they do clearly have high-tech weapons and stuff like that. And so if they want, this is kind of the Watchmen scenario, right? That they may be setting up for some narrative. And I'll tell you, a frighteningly large number of people, like this monolith thing, have you followed that at all? It really does seem extraordinarily stupid. And yet the media is reporting it like it's news.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, several groups of artists have pulled off some wonderful practical jokes. And their timing was perfect then compared, though, with, I mean, because they must have been working this for months, but it wound up being very synchronous with the alien story. So, you know, a lot of extra mileage. But for me, the whole monolith thing was a wonderful practical joke. Yeah, but it's going to get spun 16 different ways by 15 different conspiracy theorists. And that will be just for the next half hour.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Now, let's talk about the Texas lawsuit, because you posted it. I was saying a little bit earlier that this seems to me, honestly, I don't know what your take is on this other stuff. It seems to me to be at least a serious legal effort. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a lawyer, and he points out that this is at least they're raising a valid constitutional issue, and the states do seem to have standings. Now, that's not to say what the court's going to do, but you're not a lawyer. But what's your layman's take on that? But you're a smart guy. What's your layman's take on that?
Well, this is kind of what I expected was going to go down, that one of the states would get involved. I'm not surprised that the state that's taking the lead is Texas. But you'll notice that 17 other states came in with an amicus brief this afternoon that was also followed by a motion to intervene in his individual capacity by Donald Trump. That's come up in the last couple of hours. And then Carter Phillips and Danforth and Christy Todd Whitman and a bunch of other people have been come in on the side of Pennsylvania and the defendant states. And then there's a brief that's just been filed by a group of constitutional lawyers and law professors on the side of Texas. So things are getting interesting. As a layman, Texas case makes sense to me. I've talked to lawyers who reacted to it both ways, but the majority of the lawyers I've talked to have said, well, yeah, this is the way to do it. One of the states needs to intervene.
Yeah, it just seems like a more serious legal effort.
it cuts through lower courts and appeals, because when one state sues another, it goes straight to the Supremes, and so that's the decision, and we're done.
So let's turn to Brett Kimberlin. So I did a piece 2 years ago that I published at Medium, and that also put over at Gateway Pundit, and God bless Jim Hoff for letting me put it at Gateway Pundit, about what I think is one of the biggest stories that has been buried in the 2016 election, and it actually involves Brian Kemp from Georgia. So I'll just set this up a little bit, and then Alexander Chalupa, who's the DNC operative, 12 years at the DNC, was the person who got in touch with the Ukrainian embassy and told them not to support Trump. She did a blog post on her Facebook page that people can find very easily the day after the 2016 election. Now, she's a DNC operative, and she said on election day, the DOJ and Department of Homeland Security were working with an anonymous hacker group, and they were using anonymous big A, like connected with anonymous, like the, you know, mask wearing scary hacker group people don't really talk about anymore, but an anonymous hacker group out of Washington, D.C. And they were working with them on scanning for Russia stuff. And it turned out later, a few months later, that a number of states, including Georgia, said our voting systems were being scanned. And at first they blamed Russia, but then they looked into it, including Brian Kemp, who's the Secretary of State. Lo and behold, months later, months after Chalupa had posted this, and we'll talk about why is a DNC operative know anything about what the DOJ or DHS is doing. We'll come back to that. But they said that their scanning, the state's voting systems had been scanned with IP addresses coming from the Department of Homeland Security. So the very government body, she said, was working with these hackers, was working with it. Now, this group, the Protectors, they're called, are associated with a guy named Brett Kimberlin, and that's what we'll talk about. But first off, there's my little bit. So how would you summarize, I'll let you take it away from here. How would you summarize, if someone doesn't know anything about Brett Kimberlin, who is Brett Kimberlin?
Oh, me. You know, I try to explain that to people when they look at me like I've lost my mind. So I've got to the point where at least when people are old enough to remember the 88 and 92 elections, I asked them, do you remember the federal prisoner who claimed he was Dan Quayle's dope dealer? And people sometimes remember that, and they'll remember it, hearing about it on NPR in 88 or reading about it in Doonesbury in 92. But Brett Kimberlin was a drug smuggler and serial bomber who was doing a 51-plus year sentence in federal penitentiary back in the 80s and into the 90s, and got himself some notoriety by claiming to have been Dan Quayle's drug dealer. He got out on parole. His parole was revoked because he wasn't making restitution to one of the bombing victims. Well, they revoked his parole for 2 years, and he wound up staying for four. But in 2000, he was released on parole again, completed 5 years of supervised parole, and is now on unsupervised parole until right around Labor Day weekend in 2030, when his sentence will expire. What he's been doing for the last 20 years is running some not-for-profits based in the suburban D.C. area in Maryland that basically are left-wing activist groups. One's called Justice for Music Project. The other was originally called Velvet Revolution U.S., but his name was changed to Protect Our Elections. Then Protect Our Elections was merged with an organization called EMPR, which is Euromaidan Public Relations, a Ukrainian news website that isn't put up in English.
And EMPR is a socialist. Let me just stop you for a second on a couple points. EMPR. So first off, let's go back. You had Velvet Revolution. Then he changed the name to Protect Our Elections and has a website up about it. And by the way, I'm going to repeat the name of the hacking group that Alexandra Chalupa said she was working with is the Protectors. Now, perhaps it's a coincidence, but it's not, right? So it's not, it's this is the same group. And we'll talk about how we know that. But EMPR, who is EMPR? Who is that?
The Chalupa sisters and Brett Kimberlin.
Right. So there's actually no doubt whatsoever that a convicted felon serial bomber, right, who that's who he is working with the Chalupa sisters based on the EMPR thing. Just right there, we know that they're working together. And none of them have ever denied this, right?
They've been working together openly since 2014.
When did you first become aware of them?
The Chalupas?
Yeah.
Actually, I first specifically became aware of the connection in 2017 when the story broke about Kimberlin funding, trying to find some dirt on the incoming administration, and he wound up making the news on several internet websites, providing $9,000 for an Israeli ex-spy to go get fake documents from Italy. And it turned out that there was the Chalupa connection there. That's when I first actually figured them out.
That's this guy, Yanni. And I've interviewed Yanni twice.
Played the interview is quite interesting.
Yes. And you know what? If I haven't done so, you know, it's been a busy year, what with the pandemic and a divorce and all that stuff. But have I sent you that full interview yet, Sean?
No, I still don't have it.
Okay. I'm sorry. There's no reason except, you know, 2020. I will send you the entire, for your listening pleasure, the entire interview. Some of the stuff he's saying, you'll hear. Well, you'll hear. I can't play the whole thing because he pulls some of the stuff off record, but I'll send it to you and you'll find it very, very interesting. Because you and I have known about Kimberlin for years, going back to when Andrew Breitbart was alive. And I'll mention this because it is so weird to me that Brett Kimberlin is involved in Russiagate, because you and I knew him. The way I figured him out was at the time I first heard of Brett Kimberlin, he literally didn't have a Wikipedia page, because every time someone would go up and tell the truth about him, which is he's a convicted felon, he would file a complaint or somebody would file a complaint and his Wikipedia page would get pulled down. And then he was suing people over claims that they'd made about him. And I did my due diligence on Brett Kimberlin. I found the original stories from the Indiana papers. This is a long, like I say, going on 10 years now, nine years ago. I did my due diligence. I called one of the prosecutors who prosecuted him. And that prosecutor confirmed to me that when Brett was on trial facing these charges, that he had contacted another inmate. And again, this is early 80s. He contacted another inmate and had put a hit out on people, including this prosecutor. And the prosecutor confirmed it for me. There's no question Kimberlin was convicted of these crimes, that there was a lot of evidence against him, that he is a criminal, that he'd been convicted of perjury by the time he was 19. And what I saw was the story at the time was that a left-wing activist was censoring people who were telling the truth about him. And I, as a free speech person, didn't like that one bit. So I really researched it. I spoke to people connected directly to Kimberlin. I'm not even going to say some of the people I spoke to, because they were still afraid of him. And there are people who were involved in that situation in the late 70s and early 80s. This was the bombs were set off to cover up a murder after, just to get this. Well, let's back up for a second, because we have enough time. Let's back up and tell that story. why did Brett Kimberlin set off bombs? Why? What did the prosecution say, certainly, about why he set off bombs, John?
If you go get a copy of Mark Singer's book, Citizen K, which is the authorized biography that about Brett Kimberlin that was published in 94, and there's still copies floating around the used book areas at places like Amazon. Basically, he was involved with a middle school age girl, and in very inappropriate ways, we'll just leave it at that. And, well, I'll expand on that by saying Brett Kimberlin sued me for calling him a pedophile and lost the lawsuit. Anyway, the grandmother of the girl took the girl into her home, and then she was murdered.
The grandmother, not the girl. The grandmother was murdered.
And Kimberlin was allegedly the prime suspect for the murder. And so a bunch of bombings started happening to give the police something else to do. And basically, Kimberlin was involved in some other drug smuggling stuff and was trying to get some documents forged. And the print shop where he took the work got suspicious. And so when Kimberlin came to pick up the job, an FBI agent arrested him. And during the search of the car he was driving, the bomb-making material was found that led to him being indicted for the bombings. And he was convicted after three trials of the bombings. Meanwhile, he had also been caught smuggling about 10,000 pounds of marijuana in Texas and had pled guilty to that. So he did not have a good last few years of the 80s and into the 70s and into the 80s.
Well, okay, so when we come back, and I want to point out, this is somebody who was working with a Democratic National Committee operative. Full stop, right there, that should be a story. And yet nobody, including people who used to touch the Kimberlin story, I'm looking at you, Breitbart, I'm looking at you, Glenn Beck, people who've talked about Kimberlin before, nobody wants to touch the direct involvement of the Democratic National Committee with Brett Kimberlin. We'll be more coming up. We got John Hogue joining us. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. We are back. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. This is The Backstory on the, I think, one of the easiest. This is shooting fish in a barrel for any journalist out there who wants to cover this. The fact that the DNC was working with Brett Kimberlin, a thoroughly reprehensible character who is deeply documented, as John points out, there's a whole book about Kimberlin called Citizen K, not written by some right-wing nutjob, but written by a respected reporter. This is all, it's Brett Kimberlin. Someone's asking what the bomber's name is. Brett Kimberlin, go look him up. I did a thing a few years ago called Everybody Blog About Brett Kimberlin Day. And John, we had a lot of people at that point blogging about it. We had Glenn Beck talking about it. Glenn Beck did, I thought, a great job exposing Brett Kimberlin at the time. And Andrew Breitbart said to me 2 days before he died, I'm going to get back into the Kimberlin story. And that's not a conspiracy theory. He died of a heart attack. But 2 days before that, he'd said that to me. And my future ex-wife remembers, because she didn't want to, because the people associated with Kimberlin harassed. It probably led to my future ex-wife's disdain for journalism, attacked my wife over the death of our infant daughter at birth. And people working with Kimberlin, you remember this, Sean, went after my wife viciously every morning and would do that. Now we got a case where he's literally working with somebody from the DNC. And John, you still cover Kimberlin.
Yep.
Have you seen anybody talk about this? Anybody?
No, not recently. It's been a long time. But it's interesting. There was more than a connection to the DNC during the 2016 election. As part of the legal wrangling back and forth, Kimberlin got countersued by one of the lawyers he went after. And in that trial, which was in October of 2016, just before the election, Kimberlin testified that he and his group of hackers were working with the Department of Justice on election security. So it wasn't just the DNC that he was working with. It was the federal government, the DOJ.
Well, and let's go further than that, too. He admitted under oath that he was working with the Department of Justice. That right there should be a story in and of itself. But he'd also worked with Hillary Clinton's State Department and was getting funded by the government, where this guy was like, he was basically like a goodwill ambassador for the State Department, wasn't he? That's kind of what he was doing, right?
What he alleges was that he was involved in a program training foreign activists in how to use social media. However, when I did a Freedom of Information Act request with the State Department for the details of the contract, they said they never heard of him.
Yeah. And what's interesting is Kimberlin, and he does lie, too.
Well, at least, well, yes, but the government has been known to tell lies, too. So in that case, at least one of them is lying.
Yeah, or there's some snafu. They looked up the different convicted felon serial bombers that they worked with, and they maybe lost them in the shuffle or something like that. But I've got to say, like I say, the fact that, and then when Glenn Beck started to get into the Ukraine stuff a couple of years after I did, when was the last time you rewatched what Glenn Beck said about Kimberlin? It's up on YouTube. If people look up Glenn Beck Kimberlin, you'll find it. When was the last time you watched that, Sean?
Oh, it's been a while. I couldn't actually tell you.
Okay. I watched it again a year or two ago. It was really good. Glenn Beck, I got criticism of Beck, but he's a very good presenter. And he presented the very compelling case against Kimberlin. He interviewed people like Aaron Walker, like Paterico. He did a very good job with it. And nothing on this, bupkis on this. So do you think that Kimberlin, with all these lawsuits that he's filed and everything else, in fact, has had in fact, the chilling effect they talk about worked? Do you think it's worked for Brett? Because I can't explain otherwise why people aren't covering this story.
Well, I think a lot of people have just decided that it maybe has faded away, because quite frankly, Kimberlin's ability to do stuff, particularly in this election cycle, looks like it fizzled. He set up his It's Time 2020 website and actually abandoned it by the first week of October because it was having no effect on the election. And he's pulled all of his websites that were hosted in the U.S. down and moved them offshore. So, you know, maybe there may be a certain level of he's a non-entity now for some people, but I think it's going to be interesting to find out just exactly where he's landed and how he has affected stuff. The last thing that I saw that was anything like him trying to have influence this year was right at the end of October, he was using the EMPR site and Twitter accounts to promote the idea that there was some Ukrainian not-for-profit who was going to sue Giuliani for defamation. And, of course, that seems to have fizzled as well.
Okay, but let me posit something. Let's say you're planning an operation. You're the DNC or you're Hillary Clinton, and you're planning an operation, and part of the operation is you want to make it look as though Russia hacked the DNC. Okay, that's part of what you want to do, if that's your goal. So one, there's a few ways you could do it, but one of the ways would be to have somebody, an outside organization, actually hack the DNC, right? One way you do it is let's say, for instance, I want to collect insurance money and I want to make it look like my house was burglarized. Well, one way I could do that is to hire somebody to actually burglarize my house, break the windows, sneak in, everything else. So we've set up that crime. So when Alexander Chalupa says that the DOJ and the Department of Homeland Security were working with an anonymous connected hacker group, I would say if we know that Kimberlin had worked with the DNC in the form of Chalupa, I'm going to posit a theory here, John. If you need to get somebody to create that false flag hacking, I think I have a potential questionable suspect, somebody who I'm not saying did it, but I'm saying would be at the top of my list if I were investigating it. I would say to them, what was your relationship with the DOJ? What was your relationship with the Department of Homeland Security? Who approved this? And I think that we have that situation. I hear people talk about Seth Rich. That's BS for reasons I'm not going to go into now. I've never bought. I investigated it. When I say I never bought into it, I investigated it. We have Bill Binney saying that it couldn't have been done because of the. No, I never bought into that because it doesn't make any sense given the dates. I think someone hacked into the DNC. That's what I think. There's ample reasons to believe that. I think someone hacked into it. And if it was someone, I would start by questioning the people connected. What do you know about this Protectors group and their association with Anonymous? Do you know much about that, John?
Well, their original connection between Kimberlin and all that sort of stuff was through a fellow by the name of Neil Rauhauser. And he is a rather colorful and colorless person at the same time. But he basically is a fugitive and has been involved in all sorts of hacking and social engineering efforts. And for about the first half of the decade of the 2010s was a Democrat operative consultant.
Literally, he would do IT work for people up on Capitol Hill. And let me talk about the social media aspect of that with Neil Rauhauser. Neil, and this goes back 10 years, was known to have a bot army on Twitter. He had created, we don't even know how many, hundreds certainly, of these fake accounts on Twitter, right? So,
yes, and he has done those sorts of things on behalf of Democrats before. For example, if you remember a guy by the name of Anthony Weiner, the first time he got caught with his pants down, Rauhauser was involved in trying to help with the Twitter campaign to smooth that over.
Well, let me add one other thing. In the Alabama Senate race a couple of years ago, where Roy Moore was running, there were two weird things that had happened there that involved sort of cyber stuff by Democrats against Roy Moore. And one of them was a guy named Matt Osborne. And anybody can look this up. Matt Osborne was accused of election shenanigans against Roy Moore. Tell people who Matt Osborne worked for, John.
Well, among other things, he was literally employed by Kimberlin as the editor of a site called Breitbart Unmasked, which was Kimberlin's U.S. domestic PR flacking site. There's a tie in there as well.
Yes. And you remember someone saying New Knowledge. That was the other one. New Knowledge was there were two things that happened in Alabama. But if you look up Matt Osborne with an E, people can find this, and you'll see that Matt Osborne, who's in, I believe he's in Alabama, correct?
He's in Florence, or the immediate environs thereof.
Yeah, he lives in Alabama. So it didn't shock me. But like you say, he literally was on Kimberlin's payroll, and here he was involved in election shenanigans, electronic election shenanigans. So when you say Kimberlin's faded away, yes, I know what you mean. But I don't know how much impact he's had, since nobody has apparently ever taken a serious look at why the DHS would have. How did a DNC operative know what the DHS and DOJ were working on? Let's just start there. Why were they working? Why did Brett Kimberlin swear under oath he was working with the Department of Justice? Don't forget, also, Chalupa is connected to Eric Chermella, the CIA supposed whistleblower. And Kimberlin's connections to Ukraine go back to shortly after he got out of prison, correct? We only have a couple minutes left, because we talked about Kimberlin for 3 hours. And the more you know, I think the more, I'll just be blunt, John, because we only got a couple minutes here. Do you think I am completely nuts for wondering, A, why no one's investigated this, and B, that there might be a connection to some of the open mysteries, the open loops in the Russiagate scandal?
I am absolutely convinced that there's some interesting tie-ins there. And depending on who takes the oath of office in January, it's going to be interesting to see how some of that gets peeled back, whether it winds up being a guerrilla dump by interesting people who have interesting access to information, or whether it winds up being a formal investigation. But there's some ugly stuff to be uncovered.
Yeah, no, I agree. And of course, if Biden gets in, there's no freaking way it's going to get. But this is why I'm so disgusted with Breitbart and Beck on this issue in particular, because I know the government's not going to investigate it. That's clear. That's why journalism is so important on this stuff. And again, you know, just so you know, if I don't say it enough, I absolutely appreciate the continued diligence you've shown on this issue. And tell me where they can find your blog.
It's called Hogewash.com, Hogewash.com. And you can also listen to me on a podcast called The Other Podcast that I do with Stacey McCain and Diana Dealey. And we need to have you on the podcast again. It's been a while.
It has been. And anytime, John, anytime. And I got to remember, it's Wednesday, so I got my kids tonight. So send me a note, please. Someone out there, for God's sake. Rod, send me a note. Remind me to get the Yanni audio to John, because you got to hear it. And I'm interested in your take on it privately, because there's some, you'll hear stuff in there that I can't play publicly. I played some of it, but you'll hear it. It's very, very, very interesting. And this is, you know, the show's called The Backstory for a reason. Nobody is talking about this stuff. Look into it yourself a little bit and find out for yourself why we bring you the truth behind the headlines. I'm Lee Stranahan. Thanks, Rod. Thanks, Saul. Thanks, John. Thanks, Ahmed. Backstory.